Thank you for tuning in to year 7 of the Postmodern Realities podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. And we are so grateful that you have been supporting us in this podcast for our 7th year for 2023. I'm Melanie Cogdill, managing editor of the Christian Research Journal, and it is January 2023, and this is episode 321, which is a conversation about the teachings of Carl Jung. On this episode, I'm joined by Elisa Riddell, who is a staff writer and associate editor for the website Christ and Pop Culture. And Elisa has also previously been published at the website Salt and Iron. Elisa has written an online exclusive Viewpoint feature article for the Christian Research Journal, and Viewpoint articles are ones that address relevant contemporary issues in discernment and apologetics from a particular perspective that's usually not shared by all Christians. So we hope that readers thinking on these viewpoint issues will be stimulated and enhanced whether or not our readers and listeners end up agreeing with the author. Elisa's article is called Carl Jung and the Modern World's Wound. And our subscribers can read her article for free at our website, equip.org. And if you're not already subscribing, starting out in 2023 as a subscriber is a good way to start to get access to all of our online exclusive articles. Head on over to equip.org, click journal, and you can see the big banner where you can click and subscribe. Elisa, it's good to have you on the podcast again.
Thank you so much. Glad to be with you.
Back in 1999, we published a very in-depth article on Carl Jung, and it was called Carl Jung's War on the Christian Faith by Jay Budziszewski. And as I said a moment ago, Elisa's article is a viewpoint article, which is an opinion piece from a particular perspective, and not all Christians are going to agree with it. But as I noted, I hope that our conversation will, you know, help people hear another point of view, whether or not they agree, and that they would learn something new and be expanded by that personally. So I just wanted to note, as some longtime subscribers might have noticed when I said that we're doing something again on Carl Jung, that everything we've published on Carl Jung has definitely been very critical of him, but this is going to be a different kind of take. So maybe some people aren't familiar with who Carl Jung was, and so I would like to start out with you just talking to our listeners a little bit about Carl Jung. Who is he? What was his religious background, and how did his religious background shape him?
So Carl Jung was born in 1875 in Switzerland, and he died in 1961. Both his father and grandfather were clergymen in the Swiss Reformed Church, and Jung disliked attending church as a child, and he was pretty disappointed by his first communion. He was hoping that it would be this profound, transformative experience, and it ended up being pretty forgettable. He was also disconcerted by his father's faith, which seemed like a purely intellectual assent to ideas which he didn't really even understand, much less have a personal experience of. And Jung thought his father's preaching about grace sounded stale and hollow, like a tale told by someone who knows it just by hearsay and doesn't quite believe it himself. And Jung wrote about a spiritual crisis that his father had. He said he saw his father break to pieces against the problem of his faith and come to an early death. So from an early age, Jung was very skeptical of forms of Christianity that were mental only and that were oriented primarily around propositions and that lacked transformative inner experiences. And while Jung briefly considered becoming a minister himself, he later changed his mind and studied psychiatry and medicine instead. He was a research scientist in a psychiatric hospital and then was a psychoanalyst who worked with clients outside of a hospital setting for many years. And he also became a prolific writer on psychology and symbolism. And he was a younger colleague of Sigmund Freud, and Jung and Freud collaborated and corresponded for quite a few years before eventually having a falling out over their different theories of the human unconscious. Freud tried to explain religion away as a neurosis, but Jung actually thought that the religious instinct was good and normal and necessary in people. He thought that the psyche was by nature religious. And so Jung was always trying to bridge this perceived gap between science and religion. So he's often disliked and mischaracterized by people on both sides. Scientists are apt to think of Jung's ideas as so much woo, as New Age pseudoscience. And Christians are quick to notice his heretical theology, which was Gnostic and pantheistic. And he had an interest in the occult and the paranormal. And so many are concerned that he would then be a gateway to the demonic and would be dangerous. And there is some truth to both of those critiques. But I think to properly appreciate him, we need to see Jung as a person who is trained during the heyday of scientific materialism, but who is convinced that humans are innately religious beings. And he thought that rather than religion being the crutch of a neurotic mind, he thought it's actually when we try to leave religion behind that we make ourselves neurotic and unhealthy. So he was trying to work this in-between space of depth psychology, which was a difficult place to be in. He was trying to solve the mind-body problem. And that doesn't mean his answers or his approach were always correct, but he was attempting to address a real problem for human flourishing that the scientific revolution had triggered. So to sum it up, he was coming from a Reformed Protestant background that he felt was lacking transformative depth and that had crushed his father. And Jung thought the Protestant church of his day had too much in common with the overly rational mindset of the time, that it was kind of too much of a piece with scientific materialism and didn't take religious experience seriously enough. So while on the one hand, he's saying to fellow scientists that people are naturally religious, he's saying to Protestants, you're not religious enough.
So one of the ways that, you know, our listeners might already be familiar with some of Carl Jung's ideas and not really realize that some of these ideas are from him, or maybe well-known ways that they've been attributed to him. And what kind of theories that come from him that many of us have already adopted without knowing it? The one thing I can think of is some of the personality tests that are out there, I think, have Jungian roots.
Yes. Yeah. If you've ever taken a Myers-Briggs personality test, then you're dealing with kind of pre-chewed, bite-sized Jungian personality theory. Jung didn't create that test or that framework, but it was based on terms and concepts that he developed, including the ideas of introversion and extroversion, which, you know, most of us use very frequently. Jung also contributed key insights to the idea of the midlife crisis, which is also common parlance now. He thought the midlife crisis was fundamentally a religious thing in nature, that when a person has solved the problems of the first half of life, like developing a sense of identity, establishing a career, finding a partner, starting a family, and being established, that once those problems are solved, each person hits this point of, is this it? What's the point of my life? And then we have to do the work of kind of unraveling and transcending the ego and the persona that we just spent 40 years building. So a lot of ideas on that are from him. And another impact of Jung's ideas can be seen in the founding of Alcoholics Anonymous, in its 12-step program that begins with his recognition of being powerless over alcohol, that life has become unmanageable, and that only a power greater than ourselves can restore us to sanity. So we turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understand him. The formulation of that approach was borrowed from advice that Jung gave to one of his alcoholic patients, and kind of word got around and ended up taking root in the founder of AA. So those are a few of his ideas that have kind of trickled down into popular consciousness and aren't particularly controversial.
I think all of us have taken a personality test of some kind. You mentioned Myers-Briggs, but there, even if you haven't, you've heard those terms out there, I'm sure. And there's all kinds of different tests out there, Enneagram and so forth, that probably have some roots in Jung. So you talked briefly about the unconscious when you talked about his relationship with Freud, but one of his key ideas in his work that we have an unconscious side to us. So can you kind of describe a little bit about Jung's theory of the unconscious, and especially not everyone's familiar with his views. I mean, they've made their way into popular culture, but they might not know exactly what his specific views are since he lived so long ago.
So similar to Freud, Jung believed that each person has a personal unconscious that is made up of forgotten experiences, repressed memories, and parts of yourself that you reject or are simply oblivious to. The unconscious is that enormous part of you that functions on autopilot, that habitual, physical, instinctual, unthinking part of you that is real, but is always behind the scenes. Jung described the unconscious this way. He said, "In each of us is another whom we do not know. He speaks to us in dreams and tells us how differently he sees us from the way we see ourselves." Jung believed that dreams are impartial, spontaneous creations of the unconscious psyche outside the control of the will. He wrote that dreams show us the unvarnished natural truth and are therefore fitted, as nothing else is, to give us back an attitude that accords with our basic human nature when our consciousness has strayed too far from its foundations and run into an impasse. So from Jung's perspective, the unconscious can balance us out if we're willing to pay attention, because it compensates for the one-sidedness, self-sufficiency, and pride of the conscious ego, that part of you that you think, oh, that's me, the part of you that's self-aware. That's what Jung called the ego. So just as a walk in the woods or an hour in the garden or a week by the sea has the potential to recalibrate you after, you know, too much civilization, so contact with the unconscious can provide you with an opportunity for a reset. At least that's what Jung believed. He said, "Entering the unconscious, entering yourself through dreams, is touching nature from the inside. And this is the same thing as spending time in the natural world. Things are put right again," Jung said. So he thought that our unconscious mind, like our body, is a storehouse of relics and memories of the past. So he thought that's why it's possible to be a mystery to yourself, because you're not only a human individual, you're an instantiation of human nature. So you're full of undiscovered countries. You can sabotage your own plans. You can lead a double life. You can be your own worst enemy. On the negative side, but on the positive side, you can bury untold potential in your proverbial attic. You can surprise yourself with bursts of strength or creativity. You know, even the phrase, "I didn't know I had it in me," is evidence of the fact that there are parts of ourselves that are there, but most of the time we are clueless about them. Many of us struggle with a sense of inner fragmentation. You know, we live at cross purposes with ourselves, half-heartedly or lacking integrity. We have habits we can't break. You know, how many of us have made a New Year's resolution and we don't keep it? Right? We work at cross purposes with ourselves. Our conscious said, "I'm going to do this." And the unconscious said, "No way, Jose." You know, that happens all the time. Some of this discordance between what we say we value and how we actually act, you know, that those don't line up, some of that is due to sin, but not all of it. It's not always sin. So it's common for your conscious self, your ego, to overestimate itself and to be unaware that it's just the tip of the iceberg. It often thinks that it's the whole you, the real you. But you're bigger than that. There's more to you than just that. So even if you, listening to this, you still think, "I don't have an unconscious," ask your family, because they know, they see it. Other people often see all these things that are true about us that we are totally unaware of, and we would deny if somebody was rude enough to say them out loud. So that's just a brief description of what the personal unconscious is in Jung's theory. But Jung thought that we also have what he called a collective unconscious, which is not specific to the individual, but is transpersonal. So this is the part of his personality theory that is the most original, but it's also the most controversial. He believed that over millions of years of evolution, we have inherited ancestral memories or mental patterns that epitomize our adaptations to the world. And these structures of thought in the collective unconscious, which Jung called archetypes, are forms without content. So an archetype is like a container which each culture and individual person pours their conscious experience into and which shapes the way that content looks. And this partly accounts for the similarity we see in the images, symbols, myths, and stories found in different cultures and religions across time. Jung's archetypes of the collective unconscious go directly against the idea of humans as a tabula rasa, as a blank slate that is just written on by our current culture and the personal experiences of our life. His archetypes are somewhat akin to Plato's idea of the forms, and they account for his deep interest in symbolism. There are countless archetypal figures that Jung talked about, from the mother and the trickster, or the king, the hero, but there are also archetypal events like the creation or the apocalypse. But the four archetypes he talked most about were the persona, the shadow, the anima and animus, and the self. So I'll just give a brief tap into what each of those are, and then we'll move on. The persona is the social mask that each of us wears when we're facing outward towards the world and trying to fit in and survive. We all know what this is like. You know, you got to put on your mask when you head off to work, right? You're not quite the same person you are when you're at a party as you are when you're in your own house. You know, that's the persona. And then there's the shadow, which Jung said consisted of everything about ourselves that we and society considers unacceptable. And this is often associated with the more animal instincts that have to be managed, like lust, hunger, and aggression. But the shadow can also contain things that are not morally evil, but that just because of our family of origin and how we were raised, they're the things that we were trained and told were not okay to do or were not okay to be. And then there's the collective unconscious also contains this archetype of the anima and the animus, which are the contrasexual aspects of male and female. So in Jung's theory, the anima is the feminine side of a man and the animus is the masculine side of a woman. And the last archetype that Jung talked extensively about, he called the self, which was symbolized by circles or mandalas. And the self was the whole with a capital W, the union of all these components of the person, both conscious and unconscious. And I'm just barely touching on these very complex ideas here, but if you're interested, you can kind of double click on these things and go to the library or go online and learn more about them. But I can give two different images to help people visualize and remember what the unconscious meant to Jung. I say the unconscious is like an elephant with this tiny little rider sitting on top of it. And that rider is the conscious ego who thinks it's in charge and thinks it's running the show, when really the unconscious parts of a person through habits and instinct is really taking that little ego along for a ride. And the ego is just providing a story after the fact to rationalize what just happened. And for this idea of the collective unconscious, Jung used the image of a perennial rhizome with this deep archetypal root out of which springs the flower of the individual, in which each person is a new instantiation of this abiding collective human nature that we all spring out from.
It's a new year, and it's been almost 325 episodes. I can't believe it. Since we started back in 2016. And we hope that you will partner with us in 2023 to keep going on our podcast and with our journal and help us to get the word out about all of our content and help continue to bring you this podcast for free every week. And the best way you can do that is to simply tell a friend, of course, and as always, give us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts to help us out with the algorithm and helping people discover our content. And it always helps if you're a subscriber. So please go to Quip.org to subscribe. You can also go to Quip.org to the Postmodern Realities Podcast tab under Journal and click on any of our episodes. All 321 of them have a link as a place where you can give us a tip if a subscription is not in your budget right now. But as always, thank you for your partnership and another year together on the Postmodern Realities Podcast. And we look forward to bringing you all kinds of very interesting voices that are journal authors and interesting topics, both in apologetics, Christian living, and of course, cultural apologetics. So would you say that Christians, when they think about the unconscious, maybe it sounds to them like another name for their flesh or their sinful nature or something that we shouldn't interact with? Because prior to some of the things that were developed during that time by Freud and obviously Jung, like you said, they were colleagues. You know, when you think about his religious upbringing, most people in a Christian upbringing don't think about the self or the unconscious or the unconscious mind. We just think of, okay, there's the immaterial soul and the material body, and then this is how we pursue knowing God. But we don't really think about focusing on our own particular unconscious. So can you explain that a little bit?
Sure. It's tricky. The unconscious and the shadow, as Jung described them, definitely do contain things that Christians would call, hands down, evil. So there are many desires within ourselves that are disordered and that do need to be either managed properly or just flat out repented of, things that the church would call the passions. And according to Jung's theory, those unmitigated drives would end up in the shadow, like stealing, adultery, murder, lying, all these things, you know, we get from the Ten Commandments. Like those, we would definitely agree, those are wrong. And Jung would say those get shunted aside to the shadow, the part of ourselves that we don't want to notice, that we don't want to associate with ourselves, that we say, that's not me. But Jung also said that the unconscious shadow also contains aspects of ourselves that have been wrongly rejected and repressed. So think of the little boy who's told every day, boys don't cry. Those tears that he has but isn't allowed to have, those are going to go deep down into the shadow, and he may not be able to find them for decades, even if he really needs to grieve. Or think of the young woman who's raised to believe nice girls never make a scene. You know, that young woman may become a doormat for other people. She may be taken advantage of sexually by men because she has trouble finding her no, because her no is buried deep within the shadow with all the other things that, you know, she was taught are unacceptable and rude. So, you know, from an example like that, you can see the shadow can contain virtue and strength and potential for good, because the things that our family and culture train us to reject, while they're often bad things, they're not always bad things. So exploring one's shadow can be, you know, as Jung described it, it can be like digging for buried treasure, but it can also be like exposing the skeletons in the closet. It's both. There's an ambivalence to it, as Jung described it. And Jung was also adamant that people need to become conscious of their potential for perpetrating serious evil. And that means looking into your shadow and taking a fearless moral inventory of yourself. And he was skeptical of the traditional patristic conception of evil as the privation of the good. In history, it's called privatio boni. It's this idea that evil is a parasitical corruption of the original good creation that God made. And Jung was afraid that this idea would trivialize evil, that it wouldn't, in a sense, give it enough credit. He thought that evil, like that it had its own life in a way. It had its own independent being, and that it wasn't merely the good being broken or the good not living up to its potential or the good getting degraded. Jung often tried to avoid making metaphysical statements, and he would try to limit himself just to what phenomena he saw in people. And what he witnessed in people was that we are always a mix of good and evil all the way down. And to give him the benefit of the doubt in this case, he's concerned that the Christian emphasis on the primordial primacy of the good would cause us to overlook and downplay the genuine evil that exists within us. And he was concerned that we collectively would project that undealt with evil in ourselves out onto other people, and then we would destroy one another. And we need to remember that he lived through both world wars, and he saw the dangerous unconscious forces at work in the German people as they collectively embraced Hitler. And these were just regular, ordinary Joes who colluded exuberantly with mass murder. And Jung wanted everyone to be aware of the potential within themselves for this kind of behavior. So he wanted people to know that you too could be a Nazi, and you probably would have been a Nazi if you were born into Germany at that time, and that you need to know this about yourself and, in a sense, treat yourself like a loaded gun. So Jung took evil very, very seriously. And I'd say in that way, he's actually somewhat in line with Calvin and Luther, who taught, you know, this sort of deep skepticism of your own self, and that there's a corruption that goes all the way down.
So in your article, you talk about the importance of symbolism. Can you explain the significance of symbolism, not just to Carl Jung, but how also that might differ from the church? Because is there symbolism in the church as well as Jung?
Yes. So the word symbol comes from the Greek word symbalo, which means to join, unite, or fit things together. And a lot of people assume that a symbol is just a sign, like a traffic sign, that points to something other than itself. And so it's basically arbitrary. We don't have to make stop signs with eight sides that are red. That's arbitrary. We could make them look a different way and still accomplish the same purpose. But symbols are not like signs. They aren't arbitrary, and they don't merely represent something else as if they were a secret code. Symbols are active. They do something in the world. They don't just point. Symbols participate in reality, and they mediate reality to us. They contain a union of conscious and unconscious contents, both things that we know, and then also aspects of reality that we don't yet fully know, that are beyond our grasp and beyond our experience. They're transcendent. So symbols have a surplus of meaning that, you know, overflows their banks, if you will. Some people think of symbols as being the opposite of reality, as in, oh, that's not real, that's just a symbol. But that thinking confuses symbols with signs. Maybe it'll help to think of the opposite Greek word from symbolo is diabolo, which means to put asunder or to throw apart. And that's where we get the word diabolical. So when we enter a world that ceases to operate symbolically, which I think is a fair thing to say of the world of enlightenment rationality and the scientific revolution, as well as sort of iconoclastic offshoots of the Reformation, in ditching symbols, that doesn't mean that, okay, now we have access to what's really real without all this meaning and subjectivity put between me and the world. You know, now I'm going to get to the bare facticity of the world, or in the case of Christians, now I'm going to get to the bare facts of the scriptures and what they really say. It doesn't work like that. If you dispense with symbolism, things fall apart. The anti-symbolic world isn't a world of bare facts and rational knowledge. It's a world of extreme polarization and fragmentation. You end up with a pendulum swinging hard one way and then swinging even harder back in the opposite direction, because meaning is the glue that holds our world together, and symbols are saturated phenomena. They're thickly layered with meaning, and they bring disparate parts together, and they bring opposites together into one. And so we need symbols most when we approach the limits of our understanding and when we want to approach the sacred and participate in the sacred, because symbols draw us further up and further in the words of C.S. Lewis. They humble us, because symbols, in a sense, they know more than we do. And the historical church has always been awash in symbols, from the body and blood of Christ in communion, the waters of baptism, the cross, the crucifix, icons of gospel events, reading the scriptures through a typological and analogical lens, even things like festivals and processions. Every little gesture and ritual of the Mass or of the Divine Liturgy is symbolic. Even the very architecture of traditional churches, you know, being shaped like a cross, or maybe having a dome like the Dome of Heaven, you know, sitting atop the four pillars of the earth within the pillars of the church. So that just by being in the building, you are participating in the symbol with your body. Like, all of these things have been entwined with the life and faith of the church from early on. And it's only in the last few centuries that those symbols have come to be seen as either arbitrary and dispensable, like just a matter of preference, or perhaps even as distractions or accretions to the faith or idolatrous. And I think that Carl Jung, coming from this scientific mindset, saw that humans flourish when they have a richly symbolic life, and that without that, people feel like their lives are meaningless. And so, not being a Christian himself, Jung tried to give people access to symbols, not through the church, but through their own dreams, primarily, was how he did it. And what's interesting is that this actually helped people. Many of his clients got better. And I think that's because symbolism connects with our human nature. It works with and it speaks to this deepest unconscious part of ourselves. It's a transcendent language. And Jung was trying to recover what had become a dead language in the Protestant West. And I don't fault him for doing that or for using therapy to do that. But I think his success at helping people reconnect with their human nature and experience greater levels of meaning in life and the ability to change and to get unstuck from self-destructive patterns, I think that's actually ends up being an implicit rebuke of the iconoclastic church in the West, which at times Jung wrote about explicitly. He was recovering and applying in a new way, and I would argue in a more self-centered way, unfortunately, what the church had done since the beginning in a thoroughly God-centered way, but which parts of the church had either rejected or forgotten.
You just mentioned the term iconoclastic church in the West. What do you mean by that?
I mean parts of Protestantism that tend to be suspicious of religious imagery and would be concerned that it would become idolatrous. I mean, I think it's fairly common. A lot of evangelical churches have, you know, blank walls inside the church. And I think it's the case that the blankness of the walls is a very intentional absence of imagery. Since I think the church has a very long and robust history of using symbols and images within the church. And so I think the stripping away of those things is a statement. And so I think part of what Hume was doing was a response to that stripping away.
Your article talks quite negatively about a philosophical movement of the late Middle Ages called nominalism. So can you describe for our listeners what nominalism is and why you think it had a detrimental effect on Christianity? And how's that related to Carl Jung?
Sure. So nominalism has the word nominate or nominal, which means to name. People are probably familiar with the use of nominal as a pejorative. Like if you say, oh, that person's just a nominal Christian, you mean they're a Christian in name only. There isn't a reality behind the name to which the name is attaching itself. It's just a label that they adopt. So nominalism is a philosophy that developed in the Middle Ages, and it's most famously associated with William of Ockham, and it developed as a reaction against Platonic realism. Most people have probably heard of Plato's Forms, this idea that the identities of things in the world can be known and recognized by us because individual objects each participate in a transcendent form. Like, for example, I can distinguish what a tree is from what is not a tree based on whether the thing I'm looking at participates in the form of tree-ness. You know, I can look out my door at the oak in my yard and know that's a tree. And then I can look at the picket fence behind it that's also made of wood and is the same color, but I can say that fence is not a tree, even though it has some similarities to a tree. So I can discern the identities of objects based on how much each one kind of participates in a universal archetype. So nominalism denies the reality of these transcendent forms and says instead that whatever name we give to an object is just that. It's just a name, an arbitrary label, an assertion of our will upon that particular thing. But the name doesn't necessarily land on or point to a universal reality behind the word. So the meaning of that name or identity exists solely in our heads and not out in the world. And if that seems kind of too arcane or academic to matter, I'll just point to a current cultural argument happening right now between realism and nominalism. And it's the debate over what is a woman. Is a woman just a name, just an identity that we can put onto someone by an act of the will? Or do these words actually point to a reality beyond themselves? Do the words, you know, find purchase and grip onto meaningful universals that are not arbitrary? Part of what nominalism does is that it withdraws meaning and intelligibility from the world, and it sucks it all into our own heads, in a sense. And it gives us way too much power, as if we create meaning through an act of the will, through the act of naming, as if we were God. You know, I say it, therefore it is. But that's not how human language works. Only God has a divine fiat by which he creates what is. We just use our words to point to and describe what he made. And the world that he made isn't arbitrary, but it fits together beautifully and reasonably and fractally. Everything is in some kind of relationship with everything else. But if we begin to act as though our words are like God's, that kills the interconnected relationship of things and turns humanity into the sole source of meaning making in a totally inert, dead world of stuff that's just waiting for our language to assign it an identity. And this way of thinking is deeply destructive to the life of the church, to our relationship with the world that God made and our place in it. And it makes people, I think, anxious and lonely. And as we can see today, totally obsessed with this concept of identity and with the power of words to declare and create identities. And then everything starts to be about linguistic power games and words as violence and the world as an arbitrary arena for the expression of the will to power. And nominalism leads to a pathological world and to neurotic people. And Jung saw this happening and his psychotherapy tried to do something about it. His emphasis on symbolism and universal archetypes was an attempt to help people re-mean their lives and rediscover their human nature, which isn't arbitrary. So his work was somewhat of a recovery of Neoplatonism that had long had a place within the church, but that had been kind of pushed to the side somewhat in the Reformation.
You wrote in your article that, quote, therapy stepped in where sacramental liturgy waned. And you also wrote, quote, what the reformers amputated reemerged as a phantom limb in the form of depth psychology, end quote. Can you explain what you mean by that?
So let me approach that by reading a quote from volume 11 of Jung's collected works from the chapter titled Psychology and Religion. He writes, "I am not, however, addressing myself to the happy possessors of faith, but to those many people for whom the light has gone out, the mystery has faded, and God is dead. For most of them, there is no going back, and one does not know either whether going back is always the better way. To gain an understanding of religious matters, probably all that has left us today is the psychological approach. That is why I take these thought forms that have become historically fixed, try to melt them down again and pour them into molds of immediate experience. It is certainly a difficult undertaking to discover connecting links between dogma and immediate experience of psychological archetypes, but a study of the natural symbols of the unconscious gives us the necessary raw material." So from that, you can see that Jung sees psychology and therapy as primary and religion as a useful source to draw from to help people experience wholeness and growth in a post-Christian world that has lost the thread of the story of redemption. As far as I know, Jung was one of the first psychologists to make a case that religious symbols and rituals aren't superstitious neuroticism, but are the natural movements of the psyche as it gropes towards wholeness and as it seeks for meaning. And he saw the Protestantism of his day as pretty anemic, as being too rational and not tapping into the depths of the unconscious. And he thought that was why the church was, in his words, shedding its members like dry leaves. And he saw people coming to therapy and staying in therapy because they lacked a profoundly religious outlook in life. And the church, as it was then, couldn't help them participate in that divine drama. And it couldn't facilitate a richly symbolic life for them that would heal their anxiety and despair and nihilism and trauma. Jung had a little more confidence in the Catholic Church's ability to do that for people through its sacraments and rituals. But even then, Jung felt that for many people, church just wasn't an option anymore, that ship had sailed and all that was left was psychology. I don't agree with him about that, but I do agree with him that a truly incarnational faith that embodies symbolic archetypes rooted in our human nature can make people whole. And I agree with him that the treatment of therapy is a historically new and basically compensatory practice that is picking up the church's slack and is trying to do what the ancient and medieval church used to do, which is to embed people in a world of meaning. Now the best psychology can do is to try to heal the individual psyche or perhaps heal relationships within family therapy, both of which are very valuable. But psychotherapy can't reconnect us to the wider world or to God. Therapy doesn't scale fractally the way that true religion does, and it can't replace Christianity because its scope is too narrow and it's individually tailored. It fits itself to you rather than training you to fit yourself to a larger reality. I was reading an article in the New York Times recently in which the author was saying that going to therapy is today what going to church used to be for Americans. It's the thing that all decent people do. Right. It used to be that good people go to church. Now it's good people go to therapy. And I thought that that was an interesting point being made in a secular medium, that therapy is the spiritual practice for Americans. You know, that's the sign to the world that you're engaged in doing the work.
Many Protestants are inclined to look skeptically at religious rituals and practices. I'm specifically thinking of religious iconography, which would be viewed as forms of superstition and idolatry, or even perhaps as a result of pagan influences on the church. But based on your reading of Carl Jung, how would you respond to this particular objection?
the rituals, the icons, the sacraments, the festivals, the liturgical practices of ancient and medieval forms of Christianity, which still survive in the Eastern churches and in Catholicism. That's what it looks like when you pour Christian doctrinal content into these universal human archetypes, into the patterned nature of human instinct. You end up with distinctly Christian symbols and rituals. But these archetypal and symbolic patterns are common to all humans. And so other religions and other people groups and cultures will pour their own specific content into these symbolic structures and containers, and it'll look different, but yet be recognizable to us and intelligible. And when the reformers, I'd say particularly the radical reformers, what I'm about to say is less true of Lutherans and Anglicans who've retained more of the liturgy. But when some of the reformers began rejecting aspects of the church's life as magic, superstition, paganism, idolatry, I think that what they were rejecting was less about Catholicism itself, but more about their discomfort with these universal, symbolic, instinctual forms that human experience takes. They were rejecting the archetypal forms. They wanted the doctrines of Christianity and the scriptures, but without the containers of human nature to put them in, if that makes sense. They wanted the abstract ideas of Christianity, but not the lived organic structure that it had grown into over the centuries. They wanted the mind of Christianity, but not the body of Christianity. The conscious content of the faith, but not the unconscious symbolic structure of the faith. The Reformation was, in that sense, something like an extraction, like reaching in and taking the content out of the form which held it, and thinking that this process, far from doing harm to the faith, was actually a purification of the faith, getting back to the basics, a recovery of an original and, you know, quote unquote, uncorrupted version of the faith without pagan accretions. But the perspective that I've come to is that these embodied forms, these symbolic and ritualized archetypes, are actually an unavoidable part of human nature. And to try to live out one's faith in a stripped down manner is to repudiate part of our humanness. It runs counter to the incarnation. I expect we've all heard that phrase, leave your brain at home or chuck your brain at the door, to convey the sense that your thoughts and questions are not wanted here. Well, I think that non-liturgical and low church settings often end up, probably accidentally, communicating the opposite of that. You know, leave your body at home, you know, chuck your unconscious human nature at the door, because those parts of you don't matter here, and they might even be dangerous. I think that attitude is a problem. It's this assumption that we're really just brains on a stick. I heard that phrase, brains on a stick, from Professor James K.A. Smith in one of his books on cultural liturgies. It might have been You Are What You Love. I can't exactly recall. But I read that a few years ago and was immediately like, yes, this is how the evangelical churches that I've been a part of have treated me, often with the best of intentions, but as a brain on a stick, where faith is all about mental assent to a list of propositions. And I think it's impossible for us to actually live out the faith within a minimalistic, you know, four bare walls and a sermon frame. So many evangelical churches end up taking the forms that our current culture provides rather than what church tradition provides. So you end up with the church as a business or a franchise, worship as a concert, preaching as a TED Talk, the sanctuary as a lecture hall or a concert venue, the pastor as a professional performing a job, the congregant as a consumer who selects the brand of church that best suits their needs. So if we reject the archetypal structures and symbols of the church's past, we just end up putting our doctrinal content into capitalism's containers. And then our churches cease to speak to people's deepest human nature. And so they leave.
You quoted Carl Jung as saying that, quote, man is in need of a symbolic life, end quote. So if, as you posit, Jung is right that few today in our modern culture experience their lives as symbolically meaningful, for example, as if they were participants in a divine drama, what would you say that effect has on our culture And are there any movements or trends today that show signs of people attempting to recover this symbolic drama of life?
Yes, there's definitely a bifurcation happening in conservative evangelical circles. I see many who are taking the path of deconstruction and landing in the liberal rainbow church and finding symbolic meaning by participating in this social justice drama and in religious rituals like pride parades and protests, which are their own kind of liturgy. But you've also got prominent evangelicals who are converting to older traditions in the church, like Mark Galli, a former editor-in-chief for Christianity Today. He became Catholic. And also, of course, Hank Hanegraaff, the Bible Answer Man, who converted to Eastern Orthodoxy. Plenty of evangelicals are becoming interested in Catholicism and Orthodoxy and Anglicanism because of the liturgical drama and the symbolism that they have. But there are also secular versions of this where people are searching for a symbolic role in the drama of life that really requires something of you and that you can participate in physically. You've got veganism, which is the spiritual practice of fasting, basically, for a greater goal that is typically subsumed under a kind of save the earth environmentalism. You've got cosplay, where people want to dress up like Harry Potter and go to Hogwarts or be a Jedi from Star Wars. And this isn't just kids, this is grown-ups wearing costumes, trying to be part of some larger drama. But it's commercialized and it's cheesy, and sorry, nobody really gets to be a Jedi for real. You could become a saint for real, but you can't become a Jedi. I think that transgenderism falls into this category too, as a practice of religious self-harm, kind of a self-flagellation, like a mortification of the flesh where the body has to be mutilated for the sake of revealing this idealized gendered soul. And the most devoted have the most wounds to prove their faith. They have the most surgeries. And they participate in this regularly administered sacrament of hormones, which they take into their body that's gradually transforming them into their true self, you know, into the image of their gender identity, in the way that the Eucharist is meant to transform the Christian into the image of Christ. It's a form of spiritual practice, and you can see how it's somehow downstream from Christianity, like a Gnostic heretical spinoff. So I think people are vulnerable to falling into these kinds of false liturgies or replacement sacraments because the church in the West has been pretty disembodied for a long time. And while some of these things I've mentioned are relatively harmless and maybe just immature, some of them are quite dangerous. And it's hard for people to come back if they get in too deep. I think the pull of unconscious archetypes is so strong because we are religious by nature, like Jung thought. And so if we don't engage these things Christianly, they're still going to happen. They're just going to come out sideways and turn cultish and heretical and self-harming and strange. You're going to have secular ideologies taking on a religious fervor. So I think there is wisdom in looking at church history and in trusting the church's indigenous practices rather than going along with whatever new thing our culture cooks up.
You're encouraging us to be open to Jung's insights on the human unconscious, but you also acknowledge that he had unbiblical beliefs about God. And as I mentioned at the beginning of this podcast, we did a very in-depth article back in 1999 talking about Carl Jung's war with Christianity. So can you describe his heresies in more detail? And what do Christians need to watch out for in particular?
So Jung believed that for a person to be whole, they shouldn't just dig for the buried treasure in the shadow, but that even the genuine evil they find in there, even that should in some tempered measure be adopted consciously. Because he thought that if you completely reject evil from yourself, it'll just sneak in the back door and possess you and take you down. So he thought that letting a little evil in through the front door is better than letting it burn your whole house down. Kind of like vaccinating yourself with a little bit of evil so that you don't contract the fatal disease. I think that's a charitable reading of what Jung meant. I don't agree with it, but I think that's what he was trying to say. But this is playing with fire, right? Jung had very unchristian ideas about the nature of evil. He rejected the church's teaching that good is primary and that evil is a corruption of original goodness. And this misguided conviction of his led him into dangerous theological territory. When he did venture out of psychology and into metaphysics, he believed that the devil should be included in the Trinity, making God into a quaternity, because he thought that God wasn't his whole self without his dark side, and that the devil was, in a sense, Christ's shadow, and that Christ needed the devil to be complete. So that's flat out heretical, because the scriptures and the church's teachings are clear that Christ came to defeat and destroy evil and to reconcile the world to himself. Christ didn't come to reconcile evil to himself, but to conquer evil and its effects and to restore everything to the goodness of God. So I think that Jung recognized the depth of humanity's fallenness and the way in which evil gets its tendrils into everything. And then seeing what we are like, Jung projected that image onto God and thought God must be like that too. So in Jung's theology, which we see in his book Answer to Job, Jesus doesn't die for the sins of man to redeem us, but for the sins of Yahweh in the Old Testament. Jesus isn't the conqueror of evil. He's the Father's mea culpa for being so irrational and cruel to humanity. That's Jung's interpretation of the book of Job, that Job is actually morally superior to Yahweh. So in light of Jung's views that are basically a revamped Marcionite heresy in which the God of the Old Testament is evil and the God of the New Testament is good, and also a Manichaean heresy in which good and evil are equal opposites, Christians do need to be very careful when engaging with Jung's ideas about evil and about the shadow.
In the title of your article, and in your article, you say that Carl Jung points to the modern world's wound. So what exactly is this wound? And how would you say that Christians in particular can participate in healing the world's wound?
So this wound is a crisis of meaning. And I want to give credit where it's due and say that my ideas on this are shaped by Professor John Vervaeke of the University of Toronto. And he's taught extensively about what he calls the meaning crisis. And you can find all of his lectures for free on YouTube. So I encourage everyone to go and search him out, look him up. Awakening from the Meaning Crisis is what his series is called. So I think that this wound is a kind of de-incarnation, a rupture between meaning and matter. And it certainly goes as far back as Descartes' skepticism, where the only thing he can trust in is the fact that he's thinking. He's so suspicious of his body and senses and of the intelligibility of the external world that he's left alone with his mind. He's trapped in his head. And around the same time as Descartes, you got Galileo saying that even though it appears to our senses that the sun rises in the east and sets in the west, and we're all in agreement that we're seeing the same thing, the math works better if the sun is at the center and we are going around it rather than the sun going around us. And of course, this seems so obvious to us now, but we have to remember that this was deeply psychologically traumatic for people because it meant that you could no longer trust what your senses were telling you. You could no longer trust the collective agreement of your community to determine what is real and what isn't real. The scientific revolution triggered this deep and abiding skepticism and suspicion about how we can know reality and make contact with it and put confidence in it. That skepticism enters the church too, and we see it in arguments over the Eucharist about whether Christ is really present in the host or not. And I think that concerns over self-deception really take root at the end of the medieval period as we shifted into the modern world, and our posture toward the world, instead of being one of trust, that we can trust our senses and trust that we fit within an intelligible cosmos in which every creature has its place and all things work together for good and to the glory of God, the general attitude shifts to an acidic distrust that functioned in a diabolical connection-severing way, so that we all become, in Jung's poetic words, an ant heap of individuals. This posture shift toward ourselves and the world, it has its seeds back in the 11th century church, but it really comes to full flower in the 16th and 17th centuries with the Enlightenment and the scientific revolution and the Protestant Reformation. That is still a gaping wound to this day. It's a disconnect from our bodies, from the intelligibility of the world, from one another, and from God. And this crisis of meaning has been talked about by so many different thinkers. I mean, this is Nietzsche's announcement of the death of God. This is what the Holocaust survivor Viktor Frankl wrote about when he said, "The truth is that as the struggle for survival has subsided, the question has emerged, survival for what? Ever more people today have the means to live, but no meaning to live for." And Jung was pointing to this lack of meaning in people's lives, and he thought that psychotherapy could take the remnants of religious symbolism and retool them for a post-Christian secular age, and that therapy could become a replacement for church. I think he's wrong. I don't think therapy can replace church, though it can certainly help individuals and families find healing. But it's primarily about the individual psyche. And what truly ails us is not the problem within our heads. What ails us is that so often we are stuck in our heads and we can't get out of them. We can't connect. Like Descartes, we can't connect with our bodies, with the wider social and physical world, and with God. And we're existentially alone. I mean, these are the 3 a.m. thoughts that plague people and keep them up at night. You know, am I just a meat bag? Am I just a random collection of particles that happens to think it's a person? How did I get thrown here? How did I end up in this universe that it doesn't even hate me? It simply doesn't care that I exist. It doesn't give me a second thought. You know, maybe there's just nothing after I die. Maybe I'm nothing, right? Like, this is the wound. This is the abyss. And a lot of us distract ourselves so that we don't think about it and we don't have to feel it. But our neighbors feel it, and some of us feel it. And this is why the church's sacramental liturgy is better than therapy, because its aim is bigger. It's oriented toward God and toward a fractal cosmos that gets knit back together. I quote the author Timothy Petitsas in my article from his book, The Ethics of Beauty, where he says that the great hospital for the soul is liturgy, because in liturgy we are invited to fall in love with what is most beautiful. And I think that's how Christians can participate in the healing of the modern world's wound. Go to church, and go to a church that is practicing this richly symbolic life that is consciously and beautifully liturgical. Because if you can become situated within your own body, within the world, within your relationships, and within God's love in a posture of trust, where you're rooted in a transcendent symbolic meaning, then you have a chance of healing the suspicion and fragmentation and loneliness of the modern world. And you can counter the diabolical with the symbolical. And you and your family and your church can become like an ark of connection and meaning and stability amidst the floodwaters, where everyone is just trying to not drown as they cling to some little piece of driftwood, some little self-help book they just read, or some political ideology that promises meaning, or maybe therapy is their little raft that's keeping them afloat. But if you're in the ark of the church, then you can throw somebody a line. And I have a lot more confidence in the enduring nature and relevance of the church than Carl Jung did, because God has made promises to her, to us, and he's going to keep them. So I'm still hopeful.
So finally, on a much lighter note, I have a question for Elisa. It's the new year. It's January. Do you make New Year's resolutions? And if you do, what is one that you're making this year?
Oh, man. You know, I don't do that anymore. I used to, and I think I, you know, failed myself too many times. So I don't make resolutions looking forward, but I will often kind of do a retrospective and look back over the year and think of what I'm grateful for and look at what worked out well and what I want to keep doing. But I don't really make promises to myself for the new year. Good question, though.
Well, thanks for being a guest on the Postmodern Realities podcast again.
Thanks so much for having me.
You've been listening to episode 321 from the Postmodern Realities podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Journal. Today, our guest was Elisa Riddell. She has written an online exclusive feature article that's a viewpoint article called Carl Jung and the Modern World's Wound. You can read her article for free at our website, equip.org, if you're a subscriber. And if you're not already a subscriber, please go to equip.org to subscribe.
Stay connected with the Christian Research Institute and all the new content we have coming your way. The best way to do that is to head on over to our website, equip.org. There you will find thousands of free resources right at your fingertips, from articles to video to audio, and it's all for free. You'll find our podcasts hosted there, as well as the Bible Answer Man broadcast, which is hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff and streams live every Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern. In addition, you don't want to miss out on subscribing to Hank Unplugged, which is the podcast of Hank Hanegraaff. And in that podcast, he has really in-depth, free-flowing, essential Christian conversations with some of the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people. And in addition, he has a new series on his podcast feed called Hank Unplugged Shorts, which Hank goes into the headlines in the mainstream media and refutes a lot of those cultural issues that we have in these short podcast episodes. And there's quite a few of them. You don't want to miss out on them. Now, if you want to find some of this at other places where it's all in one place, really subscribe to our YouTube channel. It's a great way to get all of our content there, our podcasts there, and different individual questions theologically that people have that Hank answers at our YouTube channel. Now, you might be thinking to yourself, I don't know how to subscribe to YouTube. I don't have a YouTube account. Well, actually, you might just have a YouTube account. If you have a Gmail address, you have a YouTube account. Just log into YouTube with your Gmail address and search for Bible Answer Man channel, and please become one of our subscribers. In addition, if you see that bell icon right there on our front page, please click that, and every time that we have new content, you will receive a notification that new content is up on our channel for you to be able to consume. So thank you so much for the ways in which you partner with the Christian Research Institute. We are grateful for you listening and reading and watching.